Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Tonight we have a Sword and Sandal Cinema Special. We have Ancient Mysteries and Mummies with Michelle Brittany and The New Peplum with Nicholas Dyack. And before we start, I'm going to share my impressions of the Freedom Force. Hercules, Isis, Merlin, Sinbad, and a Super Saramai are the Freedom Force, a superhero team HQ'd in an ancient pyramid in the Valley of Time. Hercules, beardless, long blonde hair, light blue tights, and a Liberace cape, rides Pegasus and is a star sentinel. Isis adventures independently in comics and live-action TV episodes. Super Samurai is actually a young Oriental kid named Tashi. Sinbad, who sculpts, has a short and heavy comedic sidekick named Lamprey, and Merlin appears to have become the magical mentor of these superheroes after his stint with the Camelot crew. During the 5-episode run, our heroes resolve differences between science and religion, protect the time stream, fight giant robots, and diffuse the perils that arise when foolish mortals dabble with black magic. Villains include Cagliostro, Thoth, and Morgana Le Fay, who Hercules loved but spurned when he found out she was evil. She retaliates by turning Pegasus to stone and making Hercules her personal slave. The Freedom Force is surreal and dreamlike, mild on violence, yet full of occult material that would alarm some modern-day folk who are overly concerned about the metaphysical content in cartoons. I rate this show very highly, and now we go onwards to welcome Nick and Michelle. Greetings and welcome, O scholars from the edge of time.
Good evening, Hercules. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you guys doing?
Doing very well on a Tuesday evening.
Thank you for sharing all the goodies that you found in the Sword and Sandal Cinema Facebook group. You guys find great stuff.
You're very welcome. Since moving to Phoenix, we've actually, there are many more bookstores in the area than when we were in Orange, California. So it's nice to be able to go out and look at the used bookstores that we didn't have before.
You're very fortunate because here in New York and New Jersey, there used to be a plethora of bookstores of all different kinds. And now there don't seem to be. There's like a Barnes & Noble, and then there's another Barnes & Noble. And, pretty much the used bookstores are few and far between unless you go to like Salvation Army or Goodwill. And there the selection's not always that great.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Well, I guess we're really lucky because we're just a few blocks from one of the bigger used bookstores here in Phoenix. So we're very spoiled and very appreciative at the same time.
I have one store in Teaneck, which is several boroughs over. And whenever we're that way, I drop by there, and he has a really good selection of books, but he hasn't been open since the pandemic started. So I don't know what the status is with him. But I'm glad that you guys have all those places to choose from, and you're so generous in sharing what you find. That inspires quests on my behalf.
Oh, good. Well, glad to hear that. You're getting Nick's and mine, so you get a plethora of book opportunities.
And movies and all sorts of other goodies.
Yeah. Definitely. I think the most recent was, The Secrets of Isis was kind of a interesting find that came up on my YouTube channel. And I was like, oh my gosh, I had completely forgotten about that. But I remember watching that as a little kid.
It turns out I have that series. I don't know where I put it. I found a compilation that had a disc from Isis in it, but I think I'm pretty sure I have the whole series. I think it was 3 or 4 discs. And I have the Freedom Force and the Space Sentinels and all sorts of other things that were put out by the same companies. And they had lots of superheroes. They had outer space. They had prehistoric times. You know, it was a pretty full interconnected universe of these cartoons and comic books and toys.
Yeah, I appreciated your opening this evening, because it made me, of course, think of all those things that we've been chatting about on the Facebook page.
Yeah, the Freedom Force was it spawned from Space Sentinels, which I'll review on another day. But it was very surreal and very strange. There was a pyramid beyond time, and these beings, you know, the Freedom Force had access to it. And they were all from different parts of, you know, myth and legend. And they pretty much stayed on their own and did their own thing and then cooperated periodically. But they seemed to be able to move backwards and forwards in time. And they kind of fixed problems in the time stream that would upset all of reality. So for the audience it was created for, it was very rich and very, very, very odd. I loved it.
That sounds really fascinating and kind of a different kind of program. I'm not familiar with it.
I'm sure you'll come across them. And I kicked myself in the butt. When we lived in Pennsylvania, we went to a Dollar General, and a lot of these movies were in the $5 bin. And I was thinking of, like, grabbing a few of them, you know, these collections, rather. And I said, I'll wait till next time. And then by the time we got there next time, none of them were left. And now they're pretty expensive on Amazon and on eBay.
Yeah. You know, are you still there, Hercules?
I'm still here, yes.
Oh, okay. There was kind of a weird sound. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. It is kind of like, if you see it, you better grab it, because I've been getting back interested in the Highlander IP. Nick's having a good laugh about that. But I was like, I want to get the television series, and I went on, you know, Amazon. And it's like really difficult to get. And so we went over to our local used bookstore, and Nick was great. He eagle-eyed the entire series and got it for like $50. It was really inexpensive.
Wow.
Yeah. So I got the entire series, plus I got the one season of Raven that they did. So I have the entire television series, and I've been grabbing the novelizations, or kind of like the novels to go with the show. And so Nick found, I think, like five or six for me in one place, and then when we were at another place, found a couple more. So I'm almost got all of those. I still have about three to go. I'm looking forward to like talking about Mythos at some point down the road when I've had a chance to read a bit more about him and watch some of the show that he was in the episode. So I'm not there yet, obviously. I kind of want to go back through and watch all the show again, because it's been quite a while.
We just finished watching through Supernatural, and then we started on Grimm, and I think we're in Grimm season two now. So that's something we started doing with the pandemic, binge watching shows before bed. See how many episodes we can see before we're too tired to watch anymore. But I haven't found Highlander yet, but I'm sure, you know, I have my eye on, that's one of the things on my radar. So if I spot it, I'll go immediately to it and check it out.
Yeah. Oh, I think you'll enjoy it.
Before we move on to your review, I had a question, and I really haven't kept up with Highlander as much as with other series. I remember, though, I'm pretty positive I remember, unless it was a very vivid dream, a crossover between Highlander and Forever Knight. And
ooh,
whenever I describe this to people, some people say that they remember it too, and we share what little we remember. And then other people say that that never happened, that I must have read an article somewhere that they were thinking of making that happen, but that it never happened. So I figured, let me ask you guys, because you guys know a lot more than I do about Highlander. Was such a thing ever made, or have you heard of it?
You know, I am not familiar with it. However, it's funny that you bring up Forever Night, because I actually have that series on DVD as well. So I'm going to have to check that out. And I think Nick is actually doing some quick hunting to try to find out if it's actually true or not. But I'm actually not familiar with that. But that said, I haven't watched the entire series. You know, because it was kind of hit and miss sometimes, because they'd move things around, as you know, networks were off to do. So I know I haven't seen the entire series, but you know, that would be interesting if they actually did a crossover.
Because the same people made it, and the stories fit pretty well together. It's not inconceivable that the Highlander would encounter one of the vampires that's in Forever Night over the course of their long lifetimes.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to think if they actually encountered those monsters. You know, I'm thinking Universal Monsters, Wolfman and things like that. Did you find something?
There's nothing official for a Forever Night Highlander crossover, but there is a huge fan community that wrote a lot of fiction. Lots. We're talking Star Trek level of fan fiction here.
Oh, like lots and lots of stories.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Well, there we go.
There we go.
Nick comes to save the day.
Dun, da, da, da.
Yep.
So you guys... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so you guys found EC comic collections from what I gathered, from what you shared, and from what you've said on Facebook. And I'm really looking forward to tonight learning more about that. That's something I know very, very little about.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, EC Comics has done a lot of different series over the decades, and I actually came across Mummy in Comics through another Dark Horse Comics series. I think, was it Dark? No, I apologize. It was IDW. I think about 3 years ago, they released a book on mummies in comics. I think it was in Creep and Eerie, those kind of stories.
Okay.
What I'm aware is that EC Comics also had some mummy stories, and Nick happened to come across the War Against Crime series. I actually don't know how many issues there were. I'm just taking a quick look, but they were... The War Against Crime was published from about 1950 through 1955. And so Volume 2 collects issues 7 through 11, and that's still in the 1950 year. So there must be quite a few out there. But they do have a Volume 2, and it's been released through Dark Horse Comics. They do a lot of nice volumes, so it's nice that they have this so that you can go back and read. The quality of the reprints, they've been digitally remastered, so they're really beautifully done, and it's a great way to experience those older stories through these volumes, particularly if, you know, maybe you're not as familiar with reading comics from, you know, when they had four colors or however many colors they have. you know, so it's kind of nice. It kind of brings a kind of a modern and freshness to the images so that, you know, it's something that's inviting for people to want to read.
Mm-hmm.
So in volume two, there happens to be one mummy story, and it's from the February and March issue.
There is only
11. Oh, okay. So I guess there's only 11. So it's two volumes. And so the cover artist, I always like to give a nod to our artist, was Johnny Craig. And he did, and his cover is actually from The Mummy's Curse, which was written and illustrated by Al Feldstein. And it's an 8-page story. So, you know, you don't get a whole lot of time to tell a story, so you have to, as you know, they're pretty quick paced because they are so short. So I'll try to keep the plot synopsis fairly short as well. So that way there's time to chat a little bit about like the tropes that are in there and so forth.
Okay.
So the story opens in the British Museum where there's a conversation in progress between the curator and an Egyptologist by the name of Professor Gladstone, who is fresh back from an expedition in Egypt in which his colleague, Professor Upjohn, has met his untimely death. So Gladstone vehemently does not want to return to the dig site because he has related to the curator that he saw a mummy rise out of its sarcophagus and attack him. So, you know, Blakely tells him, no, come on, you're being, you know, childish about this, you know, let's go back to the dig site. So Gladstone reluctantly agrees to go back to Egypt with the curator. However, en route, Gladstone reveals in a thought bubble and a flashback that he actually killed Upjohn by pushing him off. So readers learn through this flashback that Gladstone and Upjohn had discovered the tomb of King Amutamun, or possibly a high-ranking individual. And of course, as with all tombs, there's lots of gold and jewels and riches and things like that. So Gladstone, you know, is dazzled by all the riches and decides, hey, he could have all this if he bumps off his colleague, takes a few pieces, but goes back to the British Museum and relates, you know, that he didn't find the tomb and that kind of thing. And then he'll secretly scamper back to Egypt and take the rest of the goods. But unbeknownst to Gladstone, Upjohn actually survived the fall. So Upjohn is pretty pissed and comes up with an idea to exact revenge against Gladstone. So he goes back up into the tomb, tosses the mummy from the sarcophagus over the cliff. He wraps his own body. He lays in the coffin, and he waits for Gladstone to come back. So this is, you know, an overnight activity that happens. So in the morning, Gladstone returns to the tomb, and Upjohn, you know, rises up from the sarcophagus in this, you know, garbed in mummy wrappings, scares Gladstone, but he attacks him and starts, you know, trying to fight him, but he's also scared because he, you know, he can kind of feel through the wrappings like this seems to be a real living thing. So it's scaring him, and through the tussle, the tomb becomes unstable and the roof collapses, but not before Gladstone is able to, of course, escape and go back to the British Museum and relate his story. But Upjohn, you know, is still in the tomb. So we flash forward to Gladstone and the curator visiting the tomb. And they have to dig up the sarcophagus, and upon opening it, the men discovered the mummy, which is actually Upjohn beneath all these wrappings. He has died. But Stone is so overcome that he starts blurting out his crime, saying, "But I threw him over the cliff. How could he be in the sarcophagus?" So his mind has snapped. The crypt keeper mentions in the last panel that the sarcophagus was inscribed with, "I shall punish all who trespass my resting place." And there ends the story.
That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a fast pace. You know, they have to be quick, obviously, because there isn't a lot of time. But it was a fun story. It does encapsulate a lot of the mummy tropes that we're all familiar with, starting with the cover. Johnny Craig, the artist, definitely did a nod back to Boris Karloff's The Mummy in the scene where he awakes. There is a fellow on the cover, and he's kind of interpreting what he's reading, and you can see the mummy is starting to stagger out from the sarcophagus that's leaning against the wall. So that's a little bit of license from Craig and a nod to that 1932 film. That actual scene doesn't really take place in the comic story, but, you know, it's a really good cover. Some of the mummy tropes that we encounter in the story is, of course, you know, it seems to always be the tomb of a pharaoh or a high-ranking priest, you know, that gets portrayed in pop culture stories. And so this one is definitely no different. Although they think that it doesn't turn out to be the king, there are a lot of riches, and so they surmise that it's probably some sort of high-ranking official from that particular king's time. Of course, great riches. You know, there's gold, there's jewels. But they totally bypass the fact that, you know, today, you know, paintings on tombs, the story that those convey are just as important as the sarcophagus and the mummy and the jewels and so forth. But, you know, this is 1950, so, you know, it's very focused on the gold, the jewels, the treasures. It's interesting how one of the Egyptologists seems to be so quickly swayed by greed, which is always or quite often a trope that's used in a lot of these stories. It's a way to quickly move the story along, and this one is no different. Of course, there's murder. Somebody always dies, don't they? And sadly, Upjohn, who was pushed over the cliff, he, upon returning to the tomb, has little regard for the mummy, you know, which is a body of a person, and so there's no respect for the mummy who is just chucked over the cliff. And we come to find out, you know, the trope is always, you know, there's a curse. That's been a very long-standing trope, and in this story, they allude to, you know, was it a curse? You know, but it really isn't so much a curse as much as, you know, events arising out of the greed of one modern person. And of course, the real mummy, who is the unfortunate person that got tossed over the cliff, was really static. They had no, you know, they weren't reanimated, they weren't revived. So I find that a lot of the older comic book stories often were not really a mummy, but somebody wrapped in linens, or, you know, it was somebody...
Scooby-Dooey.
Yeah, you know, not at all related to the mummy. Like, the mummy has, you know, is there, but they have no action because they haven't been reanimated. They're just there. So those are several tropes that come up in this story. And so, you know, it's interesting. We get to see, you know, a story that's written and illustrated by Al, who was, of course, a huge name in comics. starting from, I think, probably the 30s and on. So it's nice to read one of his stories. I think that, you know, for the time period, you know, it really relied on the tropes. But I will say that there was a really nice detail to the tombs. Like, you know, although I'm not able to read hieroglyphs, I do recognize when they're real. And they definitely, you know, he obviously took time to detail and provide, you know, real hieroglyphs within his story. So that was actually kind of a nice touch, nice detail to the story. But
so the
No, go ahead.
No. Finish.
Oh, I was just going to say, and that's really the story.
So they recycled a lot of this story, and it had its antecedents, and they just put their own spin on it. And it sounds like they did a pretty good job, given the medium that they had.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I really think that, you know, you see a lot of these kind of stories, and they're done quickly. And, I mean, this really is in keeping with the tone of the mummy stories that I read in that IDW book, Mummies. I think it's Mummies and Comics. But they had probably about 30 comics conveyed in that book. And the tone and the storylines are very similar to what is happening in 1950s EC, the EC comics and the Vault of Horror that this was part of.
Thank you so very much. That was awesomely incredible. Did you get into the like the Marvel mummy? And I'm sure DC had monsters as well, like other comic book mummies.
They did. So I've actually been collecting the DC, the supernatural thriller, I believe. It's The Living Mummy.
That's Marvel.
Oh, sorry, that's Marvel. So DC, I don't think I've gotten into yet, but Marvel, IDW, and EC, the Creep and Eerie, I've gotten into. So this really fits within the realm of mummy comics in, you know, mid 20th century.
And is there a paper in the works on this?
You know, it's funny you say that. I've actually presented on Mummies 101, in which I talked about this, but it definitely probably behooves a revisit and a paper down the road. So, yeah, I think there'll be something probably on my website.
I'm glad, and I'm looking forward to your continued quest with mummies in modern pop culture.
Well, thank you so much, Hercules. I really appreciate it. And, of course, always appreciate the opportunity to discuss mummies in pop culture and in ancient Egypt on the show.
And I'm always honored and glad to have you guys here because you're awesome.
Aw, thank you so much. And with that, I will turn it over to Nick, who will go across the Mediterranean and but within keeping of EC Comics, to discuss his comics.
Valor. Before Nick starts, though, I'm going to give my impression of something else. I tried to find something unusual, you know, for Nick. So I found Little Hercules. As Zeus and Marduk vie for supremacy in the starry heavens, Zeus's half-mortal son wishes to explore what it is to be human. Zeus, of course, forbids it. But alas, for this young demigod, the call of his destiny is more powerful than his father's thunderous voice. Aided by Hera, he arrives in modern-day California and befriends Curtis, a wisecracking local. Cultures clash until common ground is found. In the meanwhile, Hera convinces Zeus to deprive Hercules of his powers and conspires with Marduk to humiliate and destroy her hated stepchild. Hercules ultimately finds, after many misadventures, that one need not be a half-god to stand triumphant against life's many challenges. One simply needs sufficient heart. Terry Hulk Hogan and his family appear throughout this fun family film. For those who want the fun to continue past the movie, there's an FYI. Season 2 of the reality show, Hogan Knows Best, contains an episode that takes you behind the scenes of this empowering production. And yes, the film can also be viewed in 3D. I did not pick up that 3D, the 3D version of this, but it exists. So, Nick, sorry for taking some of your time, and now the baton goes to you, and I'm looking forward to learning all about Valor.
Oh, you don't have to apologize. You're gold. I actually haven't heard of Young Hercules, but I have seen many Hulk Hogan films back in the 90s, though.
Uh-huh. Yeah, me too.
But Suburban Commando, Gremlins 2. Oh, yeah, quite a few.
Yes, he did.
Nick does the High Noon at Mega Mountain, I think it was.
In my mind, in my mind, after seeing Young Hercules, he'll always be Zeus.
Time for me to give it a shot. I'm always down to watch, you know, the Neopeplum television shows out there and, you know, see what people have to contribute to the canon.
Yeah, you're very thorough with that. You list things in a very timely manner, and you're very extensive.
So Michelle was talking about an EC comic series called War Against Crime, which, you know, it's crime stories. This one of them had a mummy in it. But EC Comics in the 50s, they, towards like kind of their final heyday, they started cranking out some, you know, very niche series that really didn't run that long. It was called like the New Directions series. And one of them was called Valor or Tales of Valor. And this one only ran for 5 issues. It was 1955. It came out every 2 months. But Valor, like all the other comics, they're all canceled at the same time, unfortunately. But this one focused on the historic epic genre. And so even though it was 5 issues, every issue contained a Roman a sword and sandal story. And there was also pirate stories, crusade stories, King Arthur and medieval stories. So they really focused on that kind of, you know, what would be happening 10 years later in cinema, all the peplum and peplum adjacent genres, they were doing 10 years before in comic book format. And in a way, I don't know, I wouldn't say the comic was ahead of its time, but it was definitely, it came out at the wrong time, I feel. You know, had it come out post-Hercules, because, you know, after Hercules came out and Italy had their, you know, peplum boom, you know, America was importing that stuff over here. And so, you know, you had that surge of, you know, both normal historic epics here and peplum films here and all that stuff. And I feel like this Valor series would have been more successful in the 60s rather than the 50s. But so, Dark Horse Comics keeps putting out these collections of all these old EC comic runs. And I have the hardback for Tales of Valor. And the comics are good, but the supplemental material is terrible.
Ooh.
So why I'm in here to help alleviate this stuff, because the foreword to this book, it's written by some guy named P. Craig Russell, and he's probably someone prestigious, but I wouldn't know who he is. I didn't bother to Google him. But like his entire foreword, he doesn't even talk about the comic. He basically says, You know, during this time in EC, you know, they're doing other stuff. So let's focus on the artists and where they were at in their careers. I'm like, so you're saying that the only value of the Valor comic was the artists, where they at in their careers, not about the text themselves. And that, you know, to me, that's kind of sad because, you know, I
yeah.
hate that kind of, you know, textual approach that these are stories. They all have something to say. And there's some pretty good stories in here. So it's going to kind of go through each of the stories real quick. So there's 5 classic sword and sandal stories in here in each issue. The first one in issue 1 is simply called The Arena. This one's kind of on the cliche side.
you know, it's just a guy, you know, a gladiator in the arena, you know, he wins, and he kind of wins his freedom, and he kind of enchants the empress of, you know, the Caesar at the time, and, you know, he's just so good in the battlefield that they immediately put him in command of an army, and they send him out to Greece to conquer, you know, folks out there, and he's very successful, actually. But, you know, they pick up their slaves, and he falls in love with another woman, and so they come back to Rome, and, of course, the original lady that, you know, the empress is, you know, jealous because, you know, he's eyeing this slave lady. So, you know, she basically throws the slave lady into the pit of the arena, and the guy jumps in to fend off all the lions and gladiators and stuff from getting her. And in fact, the imagery in the final panel is very reminiscent of the ending of Revolt of the Slaves. You know, they're all in there, they're kind of chained up, and things are on fire, and actually kind of gruesome.
Mm.
But, and it's an entertaining story. That one is a little cliche, but, you know, hey, that's why we like the genre.
Yes.
The next story, called The Champion, this one is surprisingly deep and dramatic. So this is another gladiator story. It's this gladiator, and he, again, like any other if you're going to make a gladiator story, your gladiator is always the most greatest warrior in all the lands. And he fights so well that his owner decides to free him. And he's like, you know, awesome, I'm going to go start my own weapons store. So he starts his smithy. And so, you know, people are coming into the arena. They're buying his weapons. He's getting really, really rich. Well, you know, one day a blind, injured beggar comes in, and his assistant's, like, being all mean to him. And the gladiator is like, no, don't be mean to him. This is a guy who was a former gladiator. And, you know, he takes a kind of, you know, reverency to him. You got to treat these, you know, former gladiators with respect. And, you know, he's blind, and, you know, he gives him some money, sends him on his way, but he gets struck down by a chariot by accident. And it kind of, you know, that fate lingers on the original gladiator's kind of conscious a little bit. Well, over a course of a couple weeks, the gladiator starts going blind. You know, he's been in battle for so long that, you know, his wounds are finally catching up to him. And he's like, you know, I don't want to, you know, be like that beggar there. I want to go out in style. So he sells his shop, and he enlists to go back into the arena because he'd rather die in the arena before, you know, blindness takes him or anything. Well, in the arena, his opponent turns out to be his son. There's a flashback sequence wherein this gladiator was a free man. He had a wife. He was taken away because he was such a good fighter, but it turns out, you know, he has a son he didn't know about, but now he knows about. And so he doesn't tell his son that I'm your father. You know, he lets his son kill him because, you know, what a noble way to die. You know, killed by your own son. Your son gets vengeance. I got a hero. It's, you know, I feel like I'm not doing it justice here. It's actually surprising.
Oh, that's pretty
deep and insightful comic.
So I'm dying to know what happened.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Did they leave it there, or did they resolve the situation with the twist?
Oh, they leave it there. Hold on, wait a second. I'm sorry, Hercules. I got a bit of allergies, so I just kind of blew my nose. No, all of these stories end at cliffhangers. You know, right as something is about to conclude it, they end it. So, yeah, this one, you know, it's implied that the gladiator is killed by his son. It doesn't show it. It's all implication. Like the first story, the gladiator jumps in to save his new bow, but they leave it at that. You know, does he fend off everyone and carry her away, or do they all get eaten by flaming lions? Flaming lions. Who knows? but
were there flaming lions in there?
You know what? Yes, they
were. Now there are, yes.
So, story number three, Cloak of Command, is about hubris. It's a kind of cliche, but not as bad. But it's this one is not a gladiator story, but it's a military story. This son of a general is out, you know, doing maneuvers, leading an army, and, you know, he's the typical, you know, I know what I'm doing. You know, even though I don't have experience, I'm pretty egotistical, but, you know, I know what I'm doing. No one dare disobey me because, you know, my dad put me here. And so, of course, you know, you could see where this is going. He's going to get his butt kicked. But, you know, he has a second command who served with his dad, And he's like, no, your dad would have done this. No, your dad would have done that. You know, he keeps telling them to shut up. So, and of course, you know, they're going through their campaign and they finally, you know, end up, you know, trapped in a mountain pass. And, you know, fortunately, you know, even though the first half of the story, you know, again, hubris, the kid thinks he knows it all. He does finally realize, oh, crap, you know, I don't know what I'm doing after all. You know, I need some help here. And he actually just wants to give up. But, you know, other people prop him up, and they come out victorious. And, you know, at the end, he realizes, yeah, you know what, I'm only as good as my men. You know, I can't do it all myself. And, you know, it ends on a kind of a positive note. Well, relatively positive. I mean, unless you're going to be conquered by General Rome, that is. So, you know, it's a story, you know, that it's more of a moral tale. You know,
yeah. A powerful life lesson.
Yeah, life lesson tale for that one. Gratitude is another kind of moral tale. It's definitely a comeuppance tale about greed. So another military story. This is a soldier, high-ranking soldier. He's out doing maneuvers. He's actually quelling some slave revolts, and he comes to a villa. And the people there, you know, haven't fled yet, and he gets enchanted by their treasures. And so what he does is he leads them out, and as they're sleeping, you know, he basically lures the slaves to find him, and they kill him. And he takes their treasure, and he buries it. And the idea is he's going to come back to this treasure later. And the crappy thing, you know, story starts out is, you know, he seems like an okay guy, but, you know, he let greed get to him. So he keeps going through his campaign, and all that's on his mind is to get back to his treasure that he stole, And he fights with such ferociousness that people are like, oh man, he's awesome. Promote this man, which they do. But finally, you know, he comes to a battle that even though they win, he's gravely injured. He's half blind. He goes to the hospital, and he's crippled. He's on crutches. And, you know, the citizens of Rome come to him. They say, hey, you know what? You are so awesome. We want to give you, you know, 50 denarii a year. And he's sitting there thinking, I got treasure, man. You know, I'm going to decline your generous, you know, 50 denarii per year. And they're like, oh, look at it. He's turning us down. How noble. Let's put a statue up about him. And he's like, yeah. Well, what they do is they put a statue up over the spot they buried his treasure. And they find his treasure, like, look at this. It's the gods have smiled upon us, you know, through your actions. We found this treasure, and we put a statue up of you. And he's like, oh, crap. So, of course, you know, everyone loves him. You know, the townsfolk of Rome all wave to him and salute him. There's a statue of him. And, of course, he's, like, eating out of barrels because he turned down the 50 denarii. And, you know, of course, he's just kind of, you know, mad because, well, dude, come on. You shouldn't have stolen those people's stuff. You got what you deserve. And the final story is another gladiator story called Dangerous Animals. And it's about a Caesar coming back from battle. And he's like, this Caesar is awesome. I mean, military genius, powerful warrior. Everyone loves him. And, of course, there's this lady who in the – you know, this rich lady's like, well, I'm going to totally seduce him and, you know, put him in my beck and call. And she does, you know, obviously it happens. So, you know, 10 years pass, the Caesar is, you know, kind of a shade of his former self. You know, he's kind of fat. He's kind of slovenly. But people feel like, well, he used to be a good guy, you know, great guy, you know, even though he's kind of a couch potato. But, you know, the woman rules, you know, by a proxy through him. Well, there's this other soldier. He's like, man, that Caesar sucks. I can do better than that. So, of course, he's bad-mouthing the Caesar, and the word gets back to the Caesar. And he's like, arrest this guy. Put him in the arena. And they put him in the arena, and they sick everything on this guy. And he's just defiant to the end, you know. Lions, I'm going to, you know, kill them all. Flaming lions, because they're flaming lions. There's not really flaming lions. But if there were, he kills them all. Elephants and jaguars, he kills them all. And, you know, he's not even scratched. And Caesar's like, well, you know, who's your next opponent? And he's like, I challenge you, Caesar. So Caesar goes down to the arena, takes off his outfit. You know, he's got his gut hanging out. And, of course, you know, the gladiator slash former soldier just, you know, kills him. And so, you know, the lady's like, oh, you know, here's a new man to fawn over. And, of course, he's like, he's not having none of that. And that's kind of that story. Not the best one. I mean, you know, you can kind of see where that was. But, you know, this idea of, like, this, he's basically a Herculean soldier, not even getting wounded in the arena at all, this dispatching everyone. It's fun. But going back to that champion one about, you know, the guy going blind and he'd rather die in the arena stuff, that was, like, legitimately a good, they should do, like, a short movie about that one, I think. But anyway. So those are the peplum-themed ones I've read from this collection of Valor. I mean, there's other ones I haven't had a chance to read yet, the medieval and Knights Templar stories, you know, all the kind of, you know, depending on how broad your definition of peplum is. But, no, it's a neat thing. I'm pretty sure there's more that could be done retrospectively about the material other than, well, good artists did stuff for them. So, you know, ideas swarming for a paper. I just think it's this wrong time period for it. Because, you know, during the time, you know, the Senna Fumetti comics weren't coming out quite yet. I mean, I think he had Prince Valiant, but that's it. You know, there really wasn't a lot of other historic epic stuff out there at the time. And, you know, this is all a precursor that would lay the groundwork for things like, you know, 300 and Hercules Faction War, you know, all those comics to come.
Very true. They sound like wonderful little stories. I would have enjoyed reading them in a comic book. Like you said, in short, like films, you know, they would have made some of them like for a short or for an entire epic.
You know, the thing is, a lot of other EC material was adopted as such. I mean, because EC had, one, they had Mad Magazine, but two, they had like, you know, Tales from the Crypt and Tales to whatever, Disturb, Scare, Creep, whatever, all that type of stuff. Anyway, they had Tales from the Crypt, so of course, you know, when that HBO series was on, they totally went back and mined that stuff.
Yes, they did. That was a movie and a television show, if I remember correctly, or a bunch of movies and a television show. So, that entered our mythology in our pop culture way beyond the initial appearance in the comics.
Now, Hercules, if I'm not mistaken, you kind of have a loose connection to EC Comics, because EC Comics created Tales from the Crypt, and Troma did their parody of it, Tales from the Crapper, and didn't you like, we're going to be in that, and they shot footage, and they're like, yeah, we can't use this footage because the filmmakers don't know what they're doing.
Well, no, it wasn't that. They got a new producer who brought in funding, and the new producer didn't like it. But I filmed it extensively for that with Debbie D, the Scream Queen. She was on my show a lot. So Troma was on our show a lot, too. So we got invited to be in that movie, and they shot some stuff inside Troma headquarters. But anyway, I don't even think it made it toward the deleted scenes or cut-out material. So that's okay. That's something that might have been, maybe.
Yeah, but, you know, I feel kind of bad because, you know, and we talked about this. We bring it up all the time, you know. Making movies, even deleted scenes and B-roll, you know, there's important stuff going on out there. And I remember buying a copy of Tales from the Crapper just because there was that off chance that a deleted scene may have had my pal Hercules in it.
And I'm
sad.
Maybe it'll be a super deluxe version one day, you know, with found footage.
But when it's all said and done, though, through various, you know, strings of intertextual connectivity, you have a relationship with EC Comics through Troma.
There you go. And I accept that connection. That's an awesome connection to have. Now, how did he recognize his son? That was the only question I had when you were sharing these stories. How did he know? Did his son look like him when he was younger, or?
Oh, no, there's a total big monologue of, like, I will face you, for I lost my dad, you know, before, and I'm here to avenge him. You know, it's one of those big narration scenes, and the gladiator is like, wait a second, he's talking about me. So, you know, total, you know, in a movie, unbelievable, you know, cinematic, what's that term, when you take something far-fetched. liberties. Yeah. But yeah, no, there's just a big, you know, monologue from the son that proclaims what he's going on, and the gladiator realizes he's talking about me. I didn't know I had a son. And so, you know, it makes for good melodrama.
Yes, it definitely does. And they could have teased it out throughout the story. I'm thinking cinematically now. Let you know, he didn't know he has a son, but you could know he has a son, and the son could be going simultaneously. This guy moves through life looking, you know, for his father initially, maybe, and then deciding that he's going to take vengeance, and then have that surprise twist in the arena. That, I think that might work.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, this could definitely be a germ of a great neo-peplum film. And, but you have two scenes, the arena and a flashback scene. It could be done cheap. That's also the other thing, you know, I'm thinking about these Valor comics, just like normal Peplum films, you know, these were made on the cheap. You know, these are all based off of, you know, tales that are not copyrighted or anything in a true kind of exploitative fashion. But, oh, yeah. Yeah, Hercules, I think the collection's like $30-$35. I got to recommend it to you. There's, you know, it's just one hardback, 5 in it. I think you would love the sword and sandal stuff in it. I mean, it keeps it grounded in reality, so there's no mythological stuff. You know, there's no, you know, gods or goddesses or anything. They keep it historically epic.
That works, and you had brought up before, you know, by whatever definition of peplum one has. So I'm going to let me ask you, and Michelle, please feel free to, you know, jump in with your answer as well. In the sword and sandal cinema communities I've been building, I'm trying to focus mostly on the classic sword and sandal because that's what most people who join these groups seem to be interested in. But I don't want to focus exclusively on that. So I've been including a lot of the new peplum, including like cartoons and comic books and so forth, and then other things that aren't Greco-Roman, like the sword and sorcery films and historical epics and, you know, Egyptian. And I'll be testing it, the waters with a knightly or an Arthurian bunch of pictures and information soon. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I had a deep thoughts about that, actually, now that you bring it up, because when I was working on my book, The New Peplum, you know, one of the first essays that got turned into me was the essay about Jupiter Ascending, Tron 2, and John Carter. And, you know, at the time when I was putting together that book, you know, still accepting abstracts, you know, I had a pretty black and white view of what Sword and Sandal was, what I was looking for. I was looking for movies like Gladiator, 300, and like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, I wrote back to the author of that essay, and I told him my reservations. You know, I didn't see Tron 2 as a Sword and Sandal film. I definitely didn't see Jupiter Ascending as one. But, you know, we had a little back and forth, and when I saw his final essay, what he's doing with it, it totally clicked with me, and it really shaped what my kind of worldview of not just peplum, but of this genre studies altogether. And to me, I'm pretty lax on it. I know folks need some hard-defined boundaries, what constitutes a genre and what's the canon of that genre, and anything outside of it should be called something else. I get that. That helps with categorization. It helps with labeling, but I'm more fluid on it. And then, and again, in the essay in the New Peplum, you know, the author, Dr. Johnson, he talks about, like, well, you know, you have a Hercules film, but now you have Hercules versus the Moon Men, you know,
right.
My fox. Now you have Hercules versus a pirate. Now you're getting into swashbuckling territory. And, of course, you know, with all these Italian stuff, you know, they're made by the same, you know, crew members and directors. So they all look the same, even if they're in a different time period. So they form like this loose canon of, okay, so when does a Hercules movie end and a pirate movie begin? And how much is that pirate film, like, is it a pirate film or is it considered kind of peplum or is it considered something else? And then, you know, when I joined all the Peplum forums, you know, I never actually would have considered the sword and sorcery films of the 80s Peplum because, to me, it's sword and sorcery. It's more magical. Mm-hmm. It's more, you know, Red Sonja and Conan. But, you know, the various Peplum articles I read, you know, they do, you know, even though it's not historic or mythological, you know, the centerpiece of those films are strongmen. you know, Conan is basically Steve Reeves. So, you know, the connections there visually. It's basically Sword and Sandal, except more magical. And, of course, you have magical Sword and Sandal. You have Jason and the Ark. You have Clash of the Titans. And so I take a very laissez-faire, hands-off approach to genre. If you can justify it to me as this is Sword and Sandal and here's why and it sounds good, I'm going to run with it. And that doesn't go just for cinema as well, but for comics, video games. I take a pretty, you know, if you can argue it and rationalize it pretty well, you're in on my book. But sometimes, I personally wouldn't call a pirate film a peplum film, but I can see where the argument is made because pirate film is historic epic falls into that peplum canon. I know that certain folks would say, the Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean films, why would you consider that peplum? While other folks will say, well, you know, if you follow this lineage of stuff, it totally is kind of a neo-peplum or something. So I'm pretty, you know, I guess the other, one more thing, because I know you've got to wrap up here in a second, is I don't want to gatekeep anything. When you start putting things into genre categories, you know, sometimes you have people out there that want to actually enforce those. And that leads to gatekeeping and exclusionary activity. And I definitely don't want to do that. I'm here to promote the genre, to talk seriously about it, and to have other people talk about it. You know, outside of the various, Facebook groups, I go on Twitter and other places. The community for Sword and Sandal stuff is dead. I mean, I think so. I mean, people will like, a show like Blood of Zeus or like a movie, but, like a horror community or a fantasy community, I just don't see that love for the Sword and Sandal community out in the wild out there. And so I really want to open that kind of back up. So, that's just kind of my stance on it.
Well, it's a worthy mission, one I embrace and one I'm totally agreeing with. My love of Sword and Sandal is, again, these classic movies I grew up with, and they supplemented the stories I would hear from my parents and the cartoon and all those things I grew up with that formed the core of, what makes me tick. So, but over the years, I've discovered other things that, and as you pointed out, also some of the samurai movies, you have like one individual who can take on everybody, and that's what's the fun thing about Conan or the peplum heroes. So yes, it's like the masks of God and Joseph Campbell. It's uh-huh. Like you have monomyths and then you have these cultural variants. But it's all the same story, that a person can face the world alone and triumph regardless of any obstacles that are thrown their way.
And also, geographical and temporal boundaries. I mean, Sword and Sandal does have that Mediterranean vibe to it, but what are the equivalents of like in Mesoamerica, the Aztecs and Olmecs and stuff, this historic epic story is going on in there. You bring up samurai. So, think of like the various Asian countries, what was going on in those periods to have, their own, heroic and epic tales going on. So, to me, it's all kind of compatible. That's why I take kind of a hands-off approach.
And on that note, we have just enough time for you guys to do your comments. 90 seconds.
All right. Michelle, you want to say anything?
Sure. So people can go to michellebrichtini.com. I've got a backlog of mummy articles at Michelle's Musings on Mummy. And if you want to check out books that I've been a part of, either editing or writing chapters, you can check out my author page at Amazon.
And I'm just at nickdyack.com, and that's where you can find me in my social media. We appreciate being on the show tonight to talk about two different runs of EC Comics, sir.
And I appreciate your being on. You're excellent guests, you're excellent friends, and I wish you the greatest success in all your endeavors and look forward to the next time we talk.
Until next time.
And take care, everybody who joined us tonight, whether you joined us live as we were speaking or whether you'll be visiting later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And there's no time to play a song, but that's okay. Be well, everybody.